This is Whitney, and you're listening to the JCast on Jabberlog.
Live from the Podcast Zone at the NINA 2013 Conference and Expo in the Charlotte Convention Center, it's Within the Trenches with your host, Ricardo Martinez.
Good afternoon. This is Ricardo with Jabberlog on the JCast, and this is going to be episode number 32 of Within the Trenches, and it is sponsored by the cool kids of 911 that you can find on Facebook, facebook.com. They have a lot of excellent articles that they post there, and I actually had a chance to, I was invited from them to Florida, to Boca Raton, so their Mini-C conference, and I got to do a few episodes there, which I'll bring up a little bit of that later on in this episode. But currently, we are sitting within the Concourse A registration area of the Charlotte Convention Center here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we're here for all week for the 2013 National NINA Conference and Expo. And with this episode today, I have with me Nathan, who is with the Denise Emberly Foundation. How's it going?
Good, Ricardo. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for being on this episode. And April, who is the Michigan NINA president.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
And then we also have Brian with DuCom. And you said it was DuPage County, Illinois? Is that
That's
right?
That's correct.
We just actually just got out from a session that you guys gave. It was the National Telecommunicator Training Requirements. And it was a good session, and it's one that, Nathan, you said right in the beginning that it's very dear to your heart, the whole foundation of what's going on with this class and the foundation that you are the president and founder of. And what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to play the audio from a video that Nathan showed all of us during the session, and it's the story behind the whole foundation, and so I'm going to do that right now.
Ready, Daddy?
I'm ready. You ready?
Denise Emberly, a devoted wife and loving mother.
Oh, my goodness.
Her husband, Nate, working three jobs to make ends meet. They'd rented a house in Northport, Florida, a perfect safe haven for their growing family, or so they thought. January 17th, Nate came home from work to find his two young sons lying together in a crib, but Denise nowhere to be found.
Have you ever known her to leave the children alone?
No.
So when do you start to freak?
I started freaking about then.
Nate called his father-in-law, Rick Goff, a 25-year veteran of the Sheriff's Department in neighboring Charlotte County.
He was like, Denise is missing. And I'm like, going, what? You got to explain what you mean by that. And he says, I'm telling you, she's missing. She's not in the house.
It would turn out she'd been kidnapped by a stranger. The suspect spotted in the driveway by a neighbor. A paunchy guy in an old green Camaro. Not long after, a stomach-churning 911 call from Denise herself, who'd managed to sneak her abductor's cell phone away from him while he was driving.
First thing was her screaming.
Does it get more awful than that to hear?
You know, she's answering a 911 operator's questions by laying on the phone listening to it.
Giving some sort of a description of the guy?
Yeah, but she's making it sound like she's talking to him. I mean, she was really smart. He never knew it. Until like 7 minutes into the call, and he finally figured his phone wasn't there, and he searched and found it missing.
That call ended before police were able to locate Denise. Then, 16 minutes later, another call came in. This one routed to the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, where her father worked.
I'm I-41 going south, and I was at a stoplight, and a man pulled up next to me, and there was a child screaming in the car.
It came from a driver, Jane Kowalski, witnessing Denise's abduction in real time, thinking it was a child banging on the window in the back.
He's going slower than I am, which is not right. Something's going on. He just turned on Toledo Bright. I don't know if I can catch up. There's a bunch of traffic and I can't get over.
Kowalski can't make the turn. She goes straight. She's lost him. But it's what happened next that would cause a firestorm of controversy.
We blew it. I say we because I'm part of that sheriff's office.
No one would ever pick up the chase where Jane left off. Hundreds of law enforcement officers in three counties, even a helicopter above. But none would ever follow that green Camaro and its screaming captive down Toledo Blade. Why? Because no one ever got the message. The 911 dispatchers had forgotten to send it out. 7 hours after Denise's ordeal began, the authorities arrested the suspected kidnapper, Michael King. But his victim, the young wife and mother, was still missing. Until 2 days later, when her body was recovered from a wooded area, just 6 miles from where she'd been last seen by that eyewitness driver. So many people would ask later, could she have been saved if the 911 dispatchers had kept their cool? It didn't help the sheriff's case that at the time the 911 call came in, there was an officer parked on the side of the very road King had turned onto when Kowalski lost
him. Well, one dispatcher thought the other had sent it out. The other thought the other one had sent it out, and they didn't send it out.
We actually had a guy sitting on the same road that drove right by him. The deputy emailed me and says, listen, I hate to say this, but I was sitting on the road and I know the guy drove right by me, but I didn't have the information. The call was never dispatched. I wasn't given the information, and he drove right by me. And if I'd have known the information, because I've been in law enforcement over 20 years, I know I would have stopped that car.
I swear every time I hear the story, it seems like there's another cop car that was in the vicinity. I've heard one, I've heard two, I've heard five.
So they're blasting past units that could have stopped it right then and there.
Yeah. There's not a doubt in my mind Denise would still be here. Not a doubt in my mind.
But the green Camaro would not be stopped until hours later. A police dragnet finally collars driver Michael King.
And then when I heard the car being stopped on the interstate by the trooper, I was pretty excited.
But where is Denise? It's Friday, the day after a shocking kidnapping in Northport, Florida. A work day, but many businesses close and scores of people skip work, joining police in the search for Denise Lee. Inside kidnapped suspect Michael King's car, police turn up Muxlow's shovel. It's muddy now. And in the backseat, there is new evidence that even when she'd lost hope, Denise Lee was still trying to outsmart her captor, leaving clues just like her dad would have wanted.
I worked undercover 15 years, so I like think some of that rubbed off on her. Plus, she liked to watch cop shows, believe it or not.
She pulled some of her hair out strand by strand, leaving DNA behind.
She left clues. She wasn't going to let him get away with what he was going to get away with.
Denise also took from her finger a simple silver ring that could only be traced to her.
Nathan, I asked you to come in here because I need to ask you a couple questions as far as her jewelry.
Nathan, her husband, his father-in-law Rick Goff by his side, must face strong evidence that Denise is gone.
We have a piece of jewelry here that I want you to look at, okay? Only you will be able to tell us if this is it or not. We're not sure, okay? Is this her ring?
Yes. It's the first ring I gave her, first Valentine's Day.
How confident are you that's her ring?
100%.
It was a ring that I gave her on her first Valentine's Day. She purposely left her ring in the back seat of his car. I know that for a fact because that ring never came off. It was tight on her finger.
It was something that she knew she left behind. You'd know it.
It took me less than a second to confirm that it was hers.
Very sad news out of Northport. The search for a kidnapped woman has been suspended. Police called off the search after the remains of a woman were found near the intersection of I-75 and Toledo Blade Road.
We've recovered the remains of an unidentified white female buried.
Out of chances, less than 3 miles away from her home, Denise Lee was shot to death. Her body found here in a shallow grave along the side of this road. It showed signs of brutal rape.
Denise is thankful that all your efforts brought her home.
I'm going to miss her so much. I don't know how I'm going to go through the rest of my life without her.
Got a picture of you I carry in my heart. Close my eyes to see when the world gets dark. Got a memory of you I carry in my soul. I wrap it close around me when the nights get cold. If you ask me how I'm doing, I'd say just fine. But the truth is, baby, if you could read my mind, goes by that I don't think of you. After all this time, you're still with me, it's true. Somehow you remain locked so deep inside. Baby, baby, oh baby, not a day goes by.
He's an angel.
Not a day goes by.
Okay, and we're back from that. And I have to say, when I was in there, you know, watching it, and then, you know, watching you, you know, have to sit there. I don't know how you're able to do it, but the fact that, you know, your reasoning for doing what you're doing now, it's so powerful and compelling, you know, to tell the story and to be able to get these standards for 911. So if you can kind of tell us what exactly you do with this foundation.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not very easy to have to sit through that. I've seen the video hundreds of times probably at this point, and I just do my best to get through it and try to be strong. And I know that she's there with me every time I watch it. So,
right.
But, you know, after seeing the outpouring of support from the community in my local area down in Florida, and then gradually became national outpouring of support from the 911 community, I decided that I wanted to do something to give back. And after talking with a lot of people, you know, that have sent me emails and letters about the state of 911 and issues with the training requirements, and then in Florida at the time not having a mandatory training standard,
right,
I decided that I wanted to create a foundation and try to use the power of Denise's story to help, you know, be a platform for improvement. And we were lucky in Florida that at that time there was a bill that was trying to be passed in Florida, and we were able to help Florida APCO and Florida NINA get it passed. And it was named the Denise Amberlee Act, and it was the first ever training standard for the state of Florida for telecommunicators. And it was just, it was a tremendous experience, a tremendous opportunity. And it was very humbling just to see the amount of, you know, support that, and the amount of change that Denise has been able to do. Mm-hmm. And she deserves all the credit.
Right. You know, I actually got my start in the 911 emergency services in Florida. And, you know, at that time, you know, listening to you guys talk about this, you know, the standards for 911, you're right. You know, there wasn't anything that was standard at that time. When I started, it was 2001. And whenever I tell my story about when I started, it was me watching my trainer and then, you know, kind of being thrown to the wolves. And I didn't know it was like that. You know, there was actually a 40-hour class that they sent us to after that, but it wasn't the standard. And as far as I knew, you know, everybody had done stuff differently. But then years later now, just a few months ago, I was in, like I was saying earlier, I was in Boca Raton for this Mini-C conference. And one of the episodes that I did was with four students of this academy. I think it's Palm Beach State College. I don't remember exactly the name. But when I was talking to them, they were saying that they had to get the certification. And at the time, I had no idea that it had to do with the act, you know, the Denise Amberlee Act. I didn't know it had to do with that until somebody contacted me later on and was starting to put it together. And then it made sense. But, you know, because they never mentioned that that's how it all started. They just said that there was a certification. So, yeah, I see all the strides and everything that's going further. Now, April, you're out of Michigan, or I am. And as you were talking in this session, Michigan ended up passing something. You said it was December 2012. Is that right?
Right. Well, the standards actually went into effect in December of 2012.
Okay.
In 2007 is when Michigan started with the training standards that they have finally gotten in place at this point. It took us 5 years, though, before those standards actually went into place. One of the things I'd actually like to talk about is the national training standards and the fact that how those have kind of come about at the national at NDC this year. Ty is the NINA. He's the education and operations director for NINA. He and I, before the NDC, had discussed the fact that we wanted to talk about some national training standards. So we had a session there. And the session, as Jameson mentioned in our session, mm-hmm. was just simply overwhelming. It was huge. I don't think any of us really expected it to be quite as large as it was. Mm-hmm. We actually truly did face all of the same things that you hear. It doesn't matter where you go. You hear the good and the bad about any types of training standards. And it was good information. But while we were sitting there, the coolest part mm-hmm. was that while we were sitting there, Ty actually received an email from the National 911 office, from Lori Flaherty's office, mm-hmm. and inviting him to participate in a meeting at the national level. And from the NDC, we decided that it was necessary for us to start a formal working group to work on these standards. And we kind of, Jameson Peavyhouse, who also spoke in the session with us, we kind of helped pushed him into being our working group chair, mm-hmm. and he's doing a great job of it. But like he said in the session today, it's going to take a long time,
right.
and it's going to take a lot of cooperation, mm-hmm. and we're going to need a lot of support, though, from a lot of different areas, which is a big benefit, which we didn't have
right.
5 years ago. So,
no, that's always good to have that backing, but what do you think it is? I guess your opinions, any one of you that's holding a lot of the stuff back. You guys are talking about funding and having to classify dispatcher to a telecommunicator or a call taker. I mean, so if what do you think is holding it back there?
I think part of the problem is you have a lot of, you know, the powers that be in the 911 industry, mm-hmm. and, you know, the NENA and APCO and, you know, even NAD, the 911 office, there's a lot of chiefs. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it was, well, who was going to be in charge of this? Who was going to take the reins? Who was going to, you know, be the one that, you know, get credit, I guess. But,
right. Okay.
But I think it came to the point that all of the powers that be in those agents, in those groups and organizations decided that, you know, we can't all just keep fighting who's going to do it, who's going to take charge.
Mm-hmm.
We just need to work together. And,
right.
I'm honored to be a part of that, and I think it's incredibly important. And it's a shame that it's taken this long, but it needs to happen. You know, it's taken this long, but it needs to happen. And I'm really, really confident and excited about what's going to happen in the near future. And it looks like the 911 office is kind of, you know, through the Department of Transportation, is really kind of taking that lead.
That's right.
I think there's a lot of different issues. It's not just any one thing. Funding is always going to be an issue, and we're going to hear that no matter where you go. I'm going to go back to Jameson, and he said something that I think is the most important piece to this. When anybody says something about funding, it shouldn't be a concern about training and funding, because it should be a normal course of the normal course of business. It's something that we should be doing now anyways.
Right.
It's not an option. You have to train your people to be able to take these calls. They're emergency communications professionals, and they have people's lives in their hands. It's not an option whether they are trained or not. They need to be trained, and they need to be trained at a very high level. That being said, there are many other issues going on besides the funding, because 911 isn't just 911. There are so many facets to 911.
Right.
You know, you've got so many different types of 911. I hate to say it that way, but I guess you could say it that way, because you've got centralized PSAPs that are a central dispatch center that are a separate entity from police, fire, EMS. You've got fire communications PSAPs. You've got EMS communications PSAPs. You've got law communications PSAPs. You've got combinations of a few of those, and then it's a varying different degrees everywhere you go. And then, you know, in the session, one of the things we mentioned was you've got 911 dispatchers who are not even looked at as a true profession when they have other responsibilities besides just being a dispatcher.
Yeah.
You know, you've got there. I was just recently speaking to somebody in another state.
I think I know which state. It's probably the same state. I heard the same story.
But this gal was telling me that in their neighboring county, their PSAP, it's a one person PSAP, that not only does their PSAP is not only responsible for just their PSAP, but also for the jail. And in the evenings, they're responsible for feeding the inmates. So when they go to feed the inmates, the PSAP is essentially abandoned during that time. And you've got however long it takes to feed those inmates, they're not answering those calls. They're not transferred anywhere else. They're simply, the calls are not being answered. It could be 6-8 minutes while they're taking this time to feed. And that's not the PSAP, that's not the dispatcher's issue. Mm-hmm. That's a systematic issue.
Right.
And that's not acceptable.
Yeah, it's not. And I can't, when you guys were talking about that, I had to shake my head. I couldn't believe that, you know, stuff like that happens, that could be, the norm, like you guys were saying, that in some places that is normal. Now, Brian, coming out of Illinois, how are you guys working with this for standards?
We're in the startup phase. 2 years ago, I was at a conference just like this, listening to a session just like the one we just participated in, and we recognized that, you know, until a national initiative goes, each state's left up to its own decision of how to move it forward. And me and a couple of my peers, Cheryl Orenberg and Ron Bono, were sitting there and we walked out the room and we said, we have to do this. We knew Nathan, we knew the story, we knew the foundation, very involved. Cheryl and Ron are very involved with the foundation, and we were like, we have to do this. So we went home and we went to Illinois APCO and Illinois NENA and said, look, we need to form a committee and we need to get the ball rolling. And that's where we're at. We're starting the process. We're building curriculum. We're identifying the goals, the objectives, who our stakeholders are, how we're going to have to take this through the legislature, where we're going to have our challenges. And to build on the question you just asked before on what the challenges are and where the pitfalls are, it is what April just said. 911's not created equal across this country. I mean, in Illinois alone, you know, you could have Cook County, where Chicago is the, you know, largest city inside the county of Cook, and there's 94 PSAPs in that one county. And they go from the third largest city in the nation's 911 center to single and two position dispatch centers. And I started my career in one of those single two position dispatch centers, and now I'm the director of, you know, a large consolidated dispatch center in the suburban area. So it's not created equal. And I think the other challenge that I think we can't ignore is, as 911 professionals, we have to recognize that when mistakes are made, we have to learn from them. And there have been some of us that have had a hard time hearing Nathan's story and have a hard time looking at the fact that we have to say we've made mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I, you know, forged a friendship with Nathan on this, is that he's using his personal tragedy to let us better ourselves. And we have to, we have to partnership and team up with that and look ourselves in the face to know that we can all do this better. And we can't let these tragedies occur. And unfortunately, it's more than just Denise's tragedy in our field. There's many that we could highlight, and we have to be willing to learn from it. And I think that's our driving force in Illinois, is to figure this out and make it work one size fits all. You know, some agencies are doing the training that's probably going to exceed a standard. That was discussed in the session as well, is that, you know, we can only come up and develop a minimum level. Protocol agencies, people that use protocols are probably far exceeding standards. Mm-hmm. And then the other component that Illinois hopes to focus on that I think is really, you know, the challenge for the entire country as well, is quality assurance, is that any certification, any curriculum development must be coupled with quality assurance. And I know, Nathan, you can speak to that on your passion. You understand that that's something we have to do. And we talk about that. There's quality assurance sessions going on at this conference now, is that you have to have it. And how you can include that in a legislative initiative becomes a very big challenge. But the reality is 911 centers have to be compelled to perform quality assurance on all of their staff so they know how we're performing. And that's, we see this in other industries. We need to make it part of ours.
Well, yeah, especially when you talk about quality assurance, every manufacturing company has quality assurance. Mm-hmm. Come on, folks. We need, you know,
pretty much every
emergency.
Company.
Yeah, we're TV. Emergency communications.
Exactly.
We need to have quality assurance.
Yeah, you know, Ron Bono likes to say, it was a session with me and Eric Perry yesterday where that you can have a Big Mac in any McDonald's across the world and it's going to be made the same way.
Exactly.
And there's a reason. That's not just that. There's two reasons. There's a protocol in place and there's quality assurance to make sure that the protocol is followed. And by God, we have a more important job than making hamburgers.
That was from another Denise Amberley Foundation breakout session. The whole Big Mac analogy.
Yeah.
That's something we did last year in Minneapolis. One. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same everywhere. I mean, it's you would think that these companies like, you know, the DirecTVs of the world and, you know, the companies that do the quality assurance, when you call their numbers, that they'd be mirroring somebody like the 911 system for how they're doing it.
Right.
And not the other way around.
Yeah.
Obviously, this job is a million times more important than you know, doing customer service for, you know, DirecTV, not hounding DirecTV. Hopefully they're not a potential sponsor, but, quality assurance to me, and especially in Denise's case, like I said in the session, I mean, if quality assurance was being done in the center that this mistake happened, I don't think the mistake would have happened. The person that was in that chair that took that call wouldn't have been doing what she was doing.
Right.
And, you know, and the whole other point of it is just getting the buy-in from people, knowing that it's not just a bad thing. It's actually a good thing to look for recognition as well as finding bad things. So it's really important.
I think one of the keys, though, is that we have to get buy-in. And it's not as much from the centralized dispatch centers that this is their only position. That's their only job. That's what they do. That 911 and dispatching is what their profession is. Mm-hmm. But it's the other PSAPs that are combined with other emergency services. It's important that they buy into this as well, because unfortunately, they have a lot of other things that they have to worry about as well. And sometimes the prioritization isn't always there.
Right. Now, is there a website or anything that people can go to that lists any type of standards or for more information on something like this?
There is, but I don't know it off the top of my head.
I believe it's on APCO's website. I know they have something like that that kind of goes over this.
Where the current states are is listed.
Right.
It was in an APCO article, news article. Okay. And I have the link, but I don't have it with me. I'll have to look it up and I can send it to you.
Oh, that'll be good so that our listeners, they can go straight from there. What I'm going to do is all the links for that as well as the foundation will also be posting on the blog post when I post up the episode here.
There might even be a link on our website to that, actually, DeniseAmberley.org. I'm actually pretty sure there might actually be a link to that article. So.
Perfect.
All right. Excellent.
Well, and if you want any more information on Michigan's training standards, they can go to Michigan.org/SNC, and then the training standards are listed there for anybody to look at.
All right. And Brian, is there anything for Illinois that people can go to if they want to get more information?
The Illinois APCO and NINA website should have a link to information from our committee, but we've yet to publish anything. We're still drafting curriculum and drafting legislation at this process. But yeah, they'll have information on at least our mission.
Okay, sounds great. Now, you know, going into the wrap-up of this episode, I just want to say thank you to all three of you, and especially you, Nathan, because, you know, thinking about all of this, you could have easily gone the other direction, and, you know, you chose to, as you said, you know, earlier, to give back, and you're doing this to, you know, help all of us get that standard training that everybody should go off of. So thank you very much for that. And once again, I'm going to put all of those links up on the blog post so that people can get more information. So for everybody who's listening, any emails that you want, concerns, comments, anything for the show, you can email the show at thejcast@thejabberlog.com. You can follow us on Twitter at WTTPodcast, as well as find us on Facebook. You can like us there, and that is facebook.com/withinthetrenchespodcast. And this episode, along with all the other episodes, will be posted later on thejabberlog.com, and it'll be available 24/7. And once again, this episode is sponsored by NINA, as well as the cool kids of 911. Thank you guys very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You just listened to Within the Trenches on the JCast. If you have any questions or would like to be a guest on the show, send an email to thejcast@thejabberlog.com.